Okay, here we go. This evening, the first question is, are we on? On the air? Good. Ajahn Brahm, what is the difference between a non-returner and an arahat? They both not get reborn again, right? Thank you. Yeah, they don't get, well, sort of. So an arahat, whoops, an arahat doesn't get reborn again. So it means as soon as they're enlightened, then that's when the seed of rebirth has been destroyed once and for all. That's why the arahat, first of all, an arahat always knows they're an arahat. Once you're enlightened, you know you're enlightened. Notice that thing about being enlightened and not realizing it. Because no, enlightened people are supposed to be wise. They can't be stupid. So if you are enlightened, you know it. Number two is that means that they still have to live out the rest of their years in this body, in this life, but when this life ends, then that's the end for them. So that's why they say there's two types of full enlightenment, in the sense of like enlightenment with something remaining. So that's the experience of enlightenment of the arahat, and then when they finally, they're called parinibbana, they finally utterly cease. Like nibbana means to cease, but pari means like utterly, completely, all around, they cease. So that's actually almost like a second nibbana, the real one. Which is why that the person who is fully enlightened, they have this wonderful phrase, they're like a workman waiting for their wages. They've done the task, they've finished the job, and now they just have to wait until the end of their five khandhas, and then they get the full wages, the cessation, finished, gone. And that's the arahat. For the non-returner, they get reborn, or they don't get reborn, they re-arise in the pure abodes. Because you don't get born into the deva realms or those realms. You just appear fully formed. You don't wear nappies in the deva realm. You don't have to go to school. You're fully formed. Nor do you die in those deva realms. They say you pass away. So the whole thing just disappears. So there's no corpses and undertakers in the deva realms. Because these are like mind-made bodies. So the mind-made bodies, that they, when the mind sort of leaves that body, the body just fades away into nothingness. So that's the non-returners, they go into those pure abodes. And that, in those pure abodes, they're not like jhana realms. In the jhana realms, you actually, when you get, you pass away from this realm, you actually go into like jhanas. It's like being in a jhana, being fixed in bliss for eons sometimes. And so that means that those beings who get reborn in the jhana realms, they cannot actually access this world. You cannot talk to the beings in the jhana realms. The jhana realms can't talk to you. But the ones in the pure abodes, they can. They're not in jhana all the time. They're just their attachment to body, their attachment to five senses is completely abandoned. So that's why, of course, they never come back to this material world. They've still got attachment to the mind there. And that's where they get reborn. That's the difference between a non-returner and arahat. But basically, if you're a non-returner, that's, you know, just one more life in the pure abodes, and then once that is all finished with, then you just fade away into nothingness, gone. Is that quite clear? Yeah? That's right, you can't really say the Buddha died. They always say parinibbana, like he ceased. He didn't die. But the people make a nice point about that, and I think it's a fair enough point. So the five khandhas of the Buddha, they were just caused and now they're no longer. So five khandhas ceased, not the Buddha. There wasn't a Buddha there to begin with. Or you might say another way is the Buddha is the Dhamma is the Buddha. Not the five khandhas, but the Dhamma. And so in that case, the Dhamma doesn't die, neither does the Buddha die. That doesn't cease. And that's depending on which way you want to look at it. And so that, especially if people, you know, as I mentioned the other day, people say, this the Buddha is gone, there's no Buddha around, but Jesus Christ still is around. You say, but the Dhamma still is around. And one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha, one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma, so the Buddha's still around. In that context. Okay, is that quite clear? Okay, next question is, Ajahn, can a meditator be visited by healing forces during deep meditation that take the form of gods and devas? During a deep sit, I experience my body as being entered by some of the Hindu deities I am familiar with because of my background. they seem to manifest a part of myself. I have been at being out of touch with this. They seem to manifest a part of myself I have been out of touch with. This had a good effect. I know this is what happens in meditation anyway, but what's with this? Archetypal stuff. I'm not the sort of person that goes in for this sort of stuff. Do I just need a good dose of antipsychotic drugs? What's happening? That's a nice question. Okay, can somebody ring the PET team, please? No, the PET team is a psychiatric emergency team. No, don't ring the PET team. Now, it's when you get into meditation, deep meditation, lovely things happen. And in particular, sort of what happens is like, I've mentioned this to a few people in their interviews, like the perception grows wings and can start to do things which you normally can't do. And when you get experiences in deep meditation, they're mind experiences, they're mental experiences. And they're just so difficult actually to give a name to give a description to. Once you understand the way that perception works in the mind, through lots of meditation, through seeing weird things, why does that appear weird? What's going on there? Or especially like when you work with nimittas, why is that different colours? Why is that different shapes? What's going on there? Is it really a light in the mind? Because the eyes are closed. What's going on there? And what you actually find out is like the world of the mind, and this is a mental experience, an experience in the mind, is just so hard for us to interpret. So what we actually do, what the mind does, it starts to get an experience which is the most familiar with what the real experience is. Something which relates to the world outside. And that's actually how you clothe the experience. That's how you recognize the experience to yourself, how you interpret it. And if you've been somebody who is familiar with Hindu deities, that's how you will see those forces, or even those beings. Which is very interesting, which is why when people in deep states of meditation or ecstasy, if they're Christians, when they see devas, they see them with wings on the back, like angels. And if they're Thais, they see them with the crowns, which you see in pictures in Thai monasteries. In different places you see them in different ways. Ah, they're different devas. Are the angels in Thailand dressed differently than the angels in Australia? And the point is, the answer is no. Devas are devas are devas. But what happens is, we clothe them. We interpret them. We see something which is like a heavenly being, a divine being, sort of a deva. And the mind interprets it, and the mind puts on those clothes, and that's how it sees it. The whole process of perception is like that. By the time the image comes to your mind, you've played with it, sort of subconsciously, and you see a deva as you expect to see it. It's the same with ghosts as well. You see the ghost as you expect to see ghosts, not as the real ones. You clothe them in your expectations, anticipations. It's incredible just what perception does. The classic tale is a tale of the person, I think it was Raymond Moody, who did this book upon people having out-of-body experiences in this hospital in the US, which had a multicultural clientele. And so the people who were sort of Indians, when they went out of their body and they went through the light, they met Lord Krishna or Vishnu or something, and they're absolutely certain that was him, because it looked exactly as in the pictures and the paintings they have all over India. And the ones who were Mahayanists, they saw Kuan Yin just as in the photos and pictures, and it was real. It was an experience. They came back and they could describe it. Yeah, that was real. And the ones who were, who else is there, like the Christians, the Anglicans, they saw God. And the Catholics saw the Virgin Mary. And they were absolutely certain they saw this, or they saw Jesus or somebody. And the atheists?
Somebody else.
No, they just think, well, yeah, they saw Uncle George. A relation. Uncle George was at the other end to meet them and greet them and say hello and say, it's not your time, you've got to go back again. You know the story. And it was fascinating. What was going on there? Is there some sort of like roster system up in heaven? There's a Catholic coming, Virgin Mary, it's your turn. Oh, this is a Hindu, come on, Krishna, come out. Of course, there's no roster system. It's actually, people are saying the same thing. But we're clothing it and giving it names. We are adding those accoutrements which make it Jesus or the Virgin Mary. I'm sure that if many Westerners, they see Jesus with blonde hair and blue eyes, just in the movies. If you're a Coptic, you probably see it just like a Southern Egyptian. It's amazing just how we make the images up. But we see that. There's a core of that which is real and common to each. And what we add to it is done through perception. So what you saw there was real. But you added so many details to that experience. But it doesn't really matter. What really matters is it was a lovely mental experience coming from meditation. The right forces coming to help and heal you. Coming to look after you. Whether that comes from your mind or comes from outside. Sometimes it's so difficult to tell. And moreover, it doesn't really matter. As long as it's doing good things, then it works. The mind is a great creator. You can create gods. It doesn't matter as long as they're good ones. And that's really worthwhile. Is it real or is it false? A wise person says both. You cannot distinguish. So it's good. If that happens, go for it again. That's what devas can be. There are real devas. But actually how we see them, how we perceive them, we actually make, we clothe them in our expectations. So if you've had lots of Western upbringing, you see those angels with wings on their backs. Angels don't need wings, they're not birds. So that's what you'll see. And you'll say, yeah, I actually saw it. And it's true to you, that's real. Any questions on that? It's fascinating. Perception is a great thing to actually to investigate when you do deep meditation, because your perception do all sorts of weird things. I already mentioned you can see like the carpets sort of be amazingly beautiful. You can see walls disappear. You see the blue sky just completely fade away into nothingness or go jet black. You can see the bodies just become skeletons and then just go to dust and then fade away. They just explode in bits of body everywhere. It's amazing what perception does. And you don't need to be scared, because if in deep meditation, you're as it were, you're in full non-control. You let go, and it just happens, and it's really weird, and very interesting, full of wonderful insights, and it just fades away, and you're left with a lot of bliss and a lot of wisdom at the end.
So I understand that the final word is that it's both just something in your head, and it's something beyond you.
Correct, because what's in your head, what's in your mind, is the most real thing of all. The mind is the forerunner of all things. It's the chief. Yeah, go on.
Does anyone know how they was for each other?
How the day was for each other, through the way, same way that the mind sees things. Like the mind is, as it were, can see, can hear, can feel. This is why that sort of in what's a good example, it's just they call it like even like the divine eye or the divine ear, where you can hear deva sounds, where you can actually see sort of other beings rising and passing away. You can see devas, you can hear sounds a long way away, read people's minds, do that all through like the power of the mind, which can almost like mimic, but not really mimic, but actually surpass sight, knowing, seeing. The same way is when people actually leave their bodies and they can actually see what's going on, they can hear what's being said. But you know, the eyes still sort of closed, and the eyes are, if they're on their back having an operation, so their eyes are looking upwards. There's no way they can actually see their stomach, what's being operated on, but they can do that. So how is actually, when you're an out of the body experience, is how are you seeing, how are you hearing? At that time the brain is actually dead, the senses are not working. But how you actually know and see is through the mind. It's fascinating. The power of the mind is really great. It's very interesting to actually to play around with that, see what can be done. When you're dead, you know what I mean. Next question. Please can we have your talk on loving kindness in the morning, along with instructions on how to do it? Okay. I'm complying. Next question. Forgive the cheekiness of a three-part question, but following on from a question from last night. Does one need to experience lots of sensory desire to understand this gratification, etc.? Okay, the answer to that one, does one need to be whipped many, many times to know that, ow, it hurts? Only if you're a stupid horse. Wise one, you get hurt once and think, oh my God, that's it, I'm not going to do that again. So how many times have you tried to control the meditation and got hurt? Well, let go, leave it alone, take it easy. And then you realise, how many times have you got into anger and ill will and hurt yourself? How many times do you have to keep on doing that? Until you realise this is not the right way to go about doing things. So does one need to experience lots of sensory desire to understand this gratification, etc.? The answer is no, you don't. If you're sharp and wise. But if you've got very dull senses, dull wisdom, dull intelligence, then sometimes you can go your whole life sort of, you know, going through this life and thinking, why is it hurting? Why am I depressed? Why is life so miserable? Why doesn't things go right? Why me? You never realise actually what's going on. So in my meditation, we actually clarify mindfulness. We're giving it superpowers. So we actually see deeply into the nature of things, into the true nature of things. So actually, this is the way you're becoming wise, so you don't have to keep suffering again and again and again out of stupidity. So, does one need to experience lots of sensory desire to understand its gratification? No. Or is some, or even a little experience enough, along with observation, inference and reflection? Yes, just a little is enough for those with sharp senses. Last night you said, lust complicates friendships and relationships. I'd be grateful to hear you speak a few words on this, so I may know where and how to investigate my own experience and challenge my craving. Thank you very much. You know, it's a wonderful... to be able to have a friend who's like a monk or a nun, because, you know, when you actually go up to speak with them, like if, you know, you're a woman and you ask questions of a monk, or if you're a man, ask questions of a nun, you know, you haven't got this sexuality business complicating matters, and, you know, you're like free of a sort of a great sort of burden of communication, and it's wonderful to have that, so you can actually relate to people as human beings rather than as a possible sexual partner. And it's so much freedom there. So when we have like lust, there's all sorts of things actually go underneath what's being said. You know, sometimes so we can hardly stop that because it's just hormonal or gender and things just happen, chemistry or whatever. And so it's marvellous if you can actually be with, you know, a real celibate, you know, someone who's, you know, away from lust. Because then you can get a much better conversation going on at different levels. I like lust and sex just underlies so much of our life, just the way we dress, just the way we speak sometimes, all the movies, the books, and even the advertisements, you know, even for those silly little things like soap powder, is what gets into sex. So isn't it wonderful that we can have part of our life where that doesn't really play a major part? And so I think it's marvellous if we have like friendships and relationships which are based on just loving kindness, like just goodwill, rather than trying to own somebody, which is what lust does. Because there are sometimes that when we have lust and romance, that we need the other person to satisfy our desires. And it's like a need, it's a dependency. Real friendship is an independency, it gives you freedom. As you've heard me say many times, the definition of love in my book is the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you ever do. You can come here, you can go. I don't own you, I don't control you. I'm not trying to amass more disciples. As a monk, I'm trying to get rid of disciples. Try and get rid of them more and more and more. Please get enlightened in this retreat so you never have to come again. So give somebody else a chance. How many of you have been coming to these retreats every year? Talk about the dull horse. So come, make yourself enlightened so you don't have to come back in. I'm trying to get rid of you. So when we say like a good friendship, a friendship is actually a freeing relationship. A relationship built on freedom. And that's why it's lovely, if you have very good friends, you can actually argue. And you have these really, really deep arguments, saying, you're really wrong. No, no, you're wrong. Okay, why? And at the end, we're still friends. That's what I call a nice friendship. A friendship which is so strong that we believe we can actually be quite open to each other and even actually say sort of what other people think, these harsh things. But we trust our friendship is greater, you know, than any disagreements. So the way the Buddha put it is that he said this is like the group of monks, how we stay friends. You meet together in harmony. When you can discuss, you can be in disharmony. But when you leave, you're in harmony. So what happens in the middle is just nature. You have disagreements. You talk it over. Think about things. Argue. But as long as you come together in peace and leave in peace, what happens in the middle is nature. It's the same with the relationship of husband and wife. You can have differences of opinion. You know, to come together in love, discuss it and argue it, thrash it out. And then leave in love. That's the hard one, to make up and say, okay, yeah, you know, but there's something which is much greater than our disagreements and differences of opinion. And that's actually wonderful when we can do that. That's real friendship. So that's, so when there's like lust, it means that we want something from the other person because we need something from them, like sensual gratification. So there's always like a dependency there and sometimes an ownership. And that makes things very, very difficult. So like real friendship is actually freeing and it's just a giving to the other person. And lust is very much a taking. That makes sense? So if it's a friendship which is like freeing, just can give to the other person. Never needs anything, never takes anything. That's the best type of friendship. Dear Ajahn Brahm, stream winner means removal, eradication of myself, ego, question mark. Okay, I was expecting this question because I missed out something from this morning's talk. If a stream winner is someone who's seen non-self, then what's the difference between a stream winner and a fully enlightened arahant? And the answer is like a stream winner has actually seen non-self. They've seen that, they know it, there's nobody in there. But the stream winner forgets. It's a view which comes, but they've got to actually attain that view. They know what's going on, but now they've got to practice to realise what they've seen. In the same way that sometimes a person realises, say they're a smoker, they know that smoking is bad for your health, but they can't stop yet. But they sure know it's bad for your health. And they've got to train, practice, until actually they're free of that addiction. When they're free of that addiction, okay, they've realised the consequences of their view. Or the shipwrecked sailor, they've seen the shore, but they haven't reached it yet. Or the Sanyutta Nikaya, some monks actually explained it this way. They went to a well. They said, look, we can see the water down there, but we can't reach it. They said, we know that bhava nirodha, the cessation of existence, is enlightenment. We know that, we understand that, we've seen that with wisdom, with stream winners, but we haven't reached it yet. Same way, we can see the water down that well, but we haven't got to it yet. When you see there is no self, then it's only a matter of time. But then the untangling of craving starts to occur. The untangling of craving because one sees, but sometimes one forgets. By forgetting, it means not that it happens willfully, but it's just the past karma of craving sometimes overcomes and blinds one's wisdom. So, for example, one may see, that lust is there's no reason for lust at all. It's just conducive to suffering, more pain, less gratification. But sometimes if one's mindfulness isn't strong, if one's trained, practiced, then that lust can overcome even a stream winner. Or anger can overcome the stream winner, but only temporarily, and then they come back to their senses. As with Ananda, the Buddha's disciple, who was a stream winner for many years. But when the Buddha was about to die, he completely lost it and started crying and said, no, the teacher is gone, the teacher is gone. The other monk said, look, you know, that's not the Buddha, that's just the five khandhas. Everything is impermanent, what arises is about to pass away. He said, oh yeah, yeah, okay. Just forgot, lost it for a while. Spoon winners can lose a pot for a while, because they haven't really reached the shore. Another way of putting it, and perhaps the most effective way of putting it, is in terms of what in Buddhism we call the three distortions of cognition. We call the vipalasas. It's just the way that we're distorted in view. Once the view is distorted, then that bends perception to suit one's view, and perception bends one's thinking, and thinking reinforces one's view. This is actually the way that delusion works. Ignorance, stupidity. Because no one thinks they're stupid. We all think we're correct. And it seems that we're correct. The evidence supports us. That's why all the Christians think that theirs is the right religion. All the Muslims are absolutely certain theirs is the right religion. Or the Buddhists, we're the right religion. And these are all intelligent people. People with integrity. How can everyone be right when they're so different? The reason is, once you have a view, you start from view, then that actually bends the world to suit your view. If you're Christians, you perceive through the Christian framework, and it's self-fulfilling. You actually perceive. If you see a deva, you see it with wings, or you go and have an out-of-body experience, you see that's Jesus. Because the perception is bent by your view, what you expect. And then you come back and say, I've seen Jesus, I've experienced these things, it's true, it's a miracle, it works, see? We're right. And this is what happens. From view, you perceive accordingly. And from perceptions, you think according to those perceptions. And they help you build up the whole edifice of delusion. That's why the other day when I challenged science, it's the same, because science has a view, a very solid view, and they perceive according to that view. And they can't see other perceptions which challenges their view. Scientists, like other people, are blind. And they're doing an experiment. They've actually got a vested interest in what they perceive. They've got a theory which they're trying to prove. That would actually bend what they see. I've done science, done experiments, and what happens if you get a result which doesn't fit the curve? You scrub it out. That's what you do. It's like an anomaly. So you scrub it out and you don't record it. Because it doesn't fit what you expect to see. Even sometimes you're not really looking for that. You just don't see it. Which I think was, I read about the ozone layer over the Antarctic. It was there for many years, people doing all the experiments up there. They should have seen it years before. But because it wasn't part of their perceptions, they just could not see it. So much of science, or like life, because it goes against our views, we just don't see it. So from views, we build up our perceptions accordingly. That's why we have like denial. If you view that, you know, you're having a wonderful time in your relationship, then you deny the perceptions are accordingly. When she says, you know, you stupid man, one night you ever listening to say, oh, isn't that really charming? You perceive it a completely wrong way. Or you just perceive, oh, she's just having a bad day. Our relationship isn't on the rocks. I mean, it's just normal. Everyone just has their ups and downs with marriage. It's just normal, isn't it? Yeah. Because you don't want to see what you don't want to see. That's how views bend perceptions. And from our perceptions, that's where all our thoughts come from. We see what we think is bare reality. We think, yeah, that's true. And we start thinking accordingly. Inferring. And that's why we always go wrong in our life. And those thoughts maintain our views. That's where all the different views come from and how they become so strong. Everyone's absolutely certain their view is right. Why? Because their perceptions and thoughts support it. They don't see that their views actually build their perceptions and thoughts. Now, what that's got to do with the stream winner and Arahat, the stream winner has perfected view. But many of the perceptions and thoughts come from the old views, the new view hasn't permeated, hasn't really sunk in. It takes a long time. The slow purple 7 lifetimes before that view, which they've seen very clearly, permeates all perceptions and thoughts, so they perceive always according to Dhamma. They think always according to non-self. When that happens, then they are arahats. That's why they say the arahat has got perfect mindfulness. It doesn't mean they're just perfect gatekeeper. It means they always remember, know the Dhamma. Perception and thought, always perfect. They always see according to non-self, impermanence, suffering. They never forget. Perfect mindfulness, never forgetting the truth. And that's the arahat. So the stream winner sees, and then they have to go and swim to the shore. So it's actually a natural process. They have to go to that shore. There's no alternative. But the way it actually occurs in practice is one's perceptions and views get more and more and more in line as the weeks, the months, the years go by with what one has seen with wisdom as truth. So it's not just one has seen the truth, one actually then lives the truth. One is the truth. One is the Dhamma. One who sees the Buddha then sees the Dhamma. That's the difference between the stream winner and the arahat. That's why the stream winner is called in Pali the learner. When you see the Dhamma, that's when you get your L plates. Before, you haven't even got your L plates yet. And that's when you start swimming to the shore. Other than that, you're bobbing up and down. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. Once you see, then that's you on the way. Yeah? What stops the non-return of becoming arahat? There's still some parts of their perceptions and thoughts which haven't been purified by their view. It's permeated much, but it hasn't permeated everything yet. They're still attached to the bliss, especially of the mind. The jhana blisses. They still think that that beautiful mind in jhanas is an absolute self. They know, they've viewed it, they've seen it isn't, but they almost forget, because those jhana experiences just can be so deceiving as being an ultimate reality, which is why I've said before that Christian mystics who get into a jhana, when they come out afterwards, if they haven't been explained to them what the jhana actually is, I can understand very easily why they say that's union with God. They've been with God. Number one, it's a hugely powerful experience. It's non-dual, there's only just a oneness there, a singleness, completely sort of otherworldly, incredible bliss and power. And the doer is gone. The major part of what you take yourself to be has disappeared. You've lost your will. Instead you've got this incredible power, beautiful experience which blisses you out. Hugely powerful. That's why people get scared when they approach these jhanas. And they come out afterwards. And all the Christian mystics will say, yeah, that's union with God. And for years they'd be a saint. No, not for years, they'd be in the list of saints. In Buddhism it's just another person with jhana. So you can actually see why these experiences happen. It's the same experience, but we interpret it through our views. That was a huge experience. What was that? And through our experience, we said, well, the only thing which is that huge, you know, in my vocabulary and what I've been taught is God. And it fits all the descriptions. And that's why, you know, people say that God exists. They've known God, they've been with God. Although all they've been is that beautiful, blissful experience. Go on, Dennis. The 7 years. I don't know why it's 7 years. Seven is a lucky number, I suppose. But that's beyond me. I don't know. There's no seeing anywhere why it is 7 years. But in many places, the seven is
seven
lifetimes. So 7 lifetimes, yeah. In many places the number 7, like in the Satipatthana Sutta, they say if you practice according to the instructions of the Satipatthana, in 7 days you become fully enlightened. Another 7.
7 days.
Some 7 days, they say.
No, 3 7 years is the least.
Sorry?
3 7 days is 7 years.
3 7 days or sometimes 70 years, but the minimum is 7 days and become fully enlightened. But there seems to be something magical about the 7. I'm not quite sure why, basically. I don't know why 7. Why not 6? I think it may be just because that's for very, very slow people. That when you have that view, yeah, you see the Dhamma is so strong, it has to actually to permeate the whole perceptual and thinking framework. So perception and conception. And eventually, you know, you have to sort of live life accordingly. You realise there's nothing there. You might forget sort of sometimes, you know, the old karma, the old ways of looking at things, the old views can sometimes affect your perceptions now, but not for that long. It's just too powerful an experience. So I don't know exactly why 7, I must admit.
You know, when you talk about these extreme limits and what you know and what you say, it doesn't often seem really academic. And I just wonder if the extreme limits sort of, bumped into some of those extreme limits? Do they express themselves differently or do they think differently?
Yeah.
What's your experience of these people?
Well, usually the monks, you know, who are Aryans, they usually keep it to themselves. They only tell their mates. But there are such people around.
Have you bumped into the view?
Yes. But not bumped into them. Not really. So there are such beings around. And such beings, it's nice actually to know exactly what's in front. What's the map of what happens? And why it happens? It's all about what enlightenment is. So it may be academic, but this is actually also relates to what's happening here. And when I started talking about the different ways that view makes perceptions, and perceptions make conceptions, and conceptions make your views, you can see this is actually the why there's so many disagreements about things. Why everyone thinks they're right. And it also should make you very scared. Am I right? And how can I know that I am not being deluded? That what I perceive is real and not just bent by my views? Am I really experiencing what's true? Am I just seeing what I want to see? How does one know truth, real truth? Or is there no such thing as truth? Because, you know, your views could be bending everything to look like truth. And it seems like truth because everything supports it. The point is that that's no evidence that it's really truthful. The only way that you can actually stop that cycle, let's say like wrong view, making perception, making a concept and thoughts which support your wrong view, the only way to stop that is through ending the hindrances. The hindrances, especially the first two, of desire and ill will. Desire means you see what you want to see. Desire. Actually, know what I've said before. The reason why girls and boys go out at night is because that desire has the freedom to make the girl you're going out with look so beautiful. In the bright light of day, you can't mistake her pimples and her ugliness. But when it's dark, so that actually you can actually bend perception, and she can bend her perception of you. Why do we do that? Because we want our perception to be bent. We want to be romantic and have the girl looking just so beautiful and the man looking so smart and so strong. That's why we go out to candlelight dinners. Because we can't see what we're going out with. Because we don't want to see what we're going out with. We want the feeling to make it look so beautiful and so nice. We want to be deluded because it's romantic. And this is the only, because of desire, that's why it bends things. Isn't it the case when people fall in love, that's the most beautiful girl in the world, that's just a tremendous man. 2 years later, what the hell did I marry that person for? What's gone wrong? Is it that they've changed? No, it's just your perceptions have changed. They're not that terrible person when you get divorced, they're just always the same. Just how you look at them, what you added to them, perceptions, what you wanted to see. So when there's desire, you bend your perceptions. You can't trust the mind when it's under power of desire. Nor can you trust the mind when it's in the power of ill will. Because then it's denial. You just don't want to see what you don't want to see. Or you just want to see the faults in things, not the truth in things, because you're in a bad mood. And the same with sloth and torpor, you're just too dull to see anything anyway. Restlessness, you've got no time to see things. And doubt, you don't trust what you're seeing anyway. The five hindrances are what stop you seeing clearly. So once the five hindrances are overcome, and there's no desire, there's no agenda, then you see things as they truly are. Which is sometimes shocking, because you're not seeing things as you want them to be. You're not seeing your wife as the most beautiful girl in the world. It's just not even a woman, it's a person. It's not even a person, it's just a body, it's just five candles. You see the beautiful woman just as a bunch of five candles. You see yourself as the same. There's nothing in there. You don't see what you want to see or what you like to see. You just see what's there. So the only way we can actually stop that cycle of delusion. So wrong view makes wrong perception, makes wrong conception, which makes more wrong view, is actually to cut the five hindrances, and then we see afresh what's really there. So that's always the way one is enlightened. Stopping the five hindrances through the practice of jhana, so we can actually see truthfully for the first time. Yeah. No. Now when it says Samma Samadhi, it's always jhana. Jhana, jhana, jhana. Mitra Samadhi is what's not jhana. Sometimes Mitra Samadhi is like this. So you're still, you're not moving, but you're dull. You're not seeing clearly. There's no clarity there. Remember the Eightfold Path, the eighth factor is jhana. So jhana is part of the Eightfold Path, it's the eighth factor. But as long as they have the right view along with that jhana, the samadhi, the first factor, then that when they actually reach the jhana, they have like a framework to understand what those jhanas are. They have the map to find their way around them and to be able to interpret them correctly. So that's why you can get jhanas without correct view. There has to be some correct view there, some correct view of selflessness. And for the Christians, it's giving up themselves for God. It is giving up the will. It's a letting go to a greater being. And that's why they get into jhanas, why Hindus can get into jhanas as well. They give up themselves to Brahman or the Paramatman. And because of that surrender, that letting go, that full abandoning, relinquishing of the doer, and they actually give it up to a greater doer, a greater idea of the doer, which they call God. Therefore they can actually enter those states. But unless one has got samadhi about anicca dukkha anatta, the Four Noble Truths, then it's very easy to misinterpret the experiences of those jhanas when one comes out. So all jhanas are samma samadhi. It's actually whether they're a lead to full enlightenment or not, is whether the other factors of the Eightfold Path are there as well. And the factors which are most important there is samadhi. Anyone who gets into jhana, it's always samasankhapa, the right intention is usually there, and they must have a great purity of conduct. So there still be all of these samavacha, samakamanta, samajiva, right speech, right action, right livelihood will be there. There's always right effort and right mindfulness will be there. The one which is missing, which will stop the person getting jhanas, is actually understanding them and liberating themselves from samsara, is the ditti, the view. Because from that wrong view, they'll interpret that experience afterwards They'll perceive it. Not as like a state of the mind being liberated from the body. They'll look at a perfect union with God. They'll take this jitta, this radiant mind, to be the ultimate being. Cosmic consciousness, the ground of all being. I won't see further than that. And that's a danger. That's one of the reasons why, even before the Buddha, in previous lives, if he was like a sage in the jungles getting jhanas, could not get enlightened. He didn't have that framework of view to actually understand what these things really mean. That makes sense? Yeah.
Buddhism with the Dhamma,
you see.
Yeah.
Buddhism with the path to enlightenment that you already. Yeah. You need the eight factors of the path to become enlightened. Samadhi is important. So also is samadhi. The two ends of the path. Samadhi is like having the map. The jhanas is like having the flashlight. So when you go in the jungle, you can actually find the treasure. If you haven't got a flashlight, then we've got the map, you just can't find your way. If you've got the flashlight but not the map, you can find your way, but you don't know where you're going. If you've got both, you've got the view, the map, the theory, and then you've also got the beautiful jhanas to actually illuminate what's happening there, then you've got that combination which will lead to nirvana. That's why we don't just do meditation, we give a lot of talks as well, so that your map is very clear. Correct, yes. Verse 372 of the Dhammapada, it's only one of the few verses I remember. Nati jānaṁ apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi jānaṁ chupanya cha sawe nibbāna santikei. Which means that there is no jhana without wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana. But one who has jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbāna. The jhana and wisdom. The wisdom here being like the view wisdom, the understanding, what you've learnt. He's saying that if you use no jhana without having learned something, been instructed. There's no real learning, real deep wisdom without those experiences of jhana. When you've got the two together, then yam hi nibbana santike, they're in the presence of nibbana. That's why if you get into a jhana and you've got some good instructions about impermanence, suffering and non-self, then you've got this amazing combination. And then it's a good chance that something can go bang. What goes bang is you. And afterwards there's nothing left. Nibbana.
Once returner
is just that they've weakened the defilements. They're on the way. But they haven't got as far as a non-returner yet. So their understanding, their view is only beginning to permeate their perceptions and thoughts, so they can still have lust, they can still have ill will. They haven't really got deep enough yet. Eventually that view goes deeper and deeper and deeper. They just can't have lust, just can't have sort of ill will, just can't be done anymore, and there's no point to it anymore, and the view has become so strong, why am I doing this? It can't be done. So it happens. Does that make sense? Yes, Sima?
I just want to ask it was confirmed before Lord Buddha that they really find they had written a jhana book, but then they didn't have the proper, they didn't have right
view, samadhi, yeah. You need that one as well as jhanas to be able to get fully enlightened. Okay, the next question, really deep questions, really good fun. Is thinking the same as contemplation? No. This is my gong bonger experiment. What is this? Maybe you've done this before. What is this? Watch your mind when you ask this question. People say it's the gong bonger, it's white at the top, it's black at the bottom, it's circular, it's round. That's called thinking. Giving it names. the inner commentary. Now, if you put this up after you've exhausted all the names and keep looking at it, that's called contemplation. You're seeing much deeper into its nature when you've exhausted all the labels, because the labels aren't the thing. Do you understand? And so much thinking is just giving the labels. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Panya, or not, Tampanya, that's Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Jnana Tusika, Tamu Dipa, Jake, you, give all these labels. Is that who that person is, Jake? There's another Jake in here as well. No, who's the real Jake? You're not Jake. It's just the name, which, the designation. But you're much deeper than that. Are you the body? Are you Australian? Are you a man? Are you stupid? Are you intelligent? Which one is it? Neither. So when you go into the nature of things, it goes way beyond thought. That's why thinking is just so superficial. And actually that's why thinking is dead stuff, as I said a few days ago, because you say this is a gong bong, because I said that a year or two ago, it's a dead idea. When you say this is Ajahn Brahm, it's because that's what you were taught years ago. You were taught at school, this is the house, this is mummy, this is a tree, this is a car. That's all dead stuff, that's old. So what actually is it? So actually to really sort of go beyond thought, you have to go to new stuff. All labels are learned from the past. They're approximations to the truth, and not very good ones. So contemplation is when you take up the thing which you think is the knower. And you stop giving it the name knower. You stop giving it the name mind. You stop all the descriptions and for a change see it as it really is. See it beyond thought. And then actually you can see what it truly is. To be able to do that, you have to put it in front of your mind for a long time and just be able to sustain attention on it. Long enough for attention to really bore in. And see what it truly is. It takes time. Thinking just passes over something so quickly. It just skims over the surface of reality. Contemplation dives into its very nature. That's what contemplation is. The difference between contemplation and thinking. Also, contemplation has to go in the right direction as well. Go to the source of things, into it. And you've heard me before and give the simile of the old cinemas of my youth in London, because people used to smoke in those cinemas. So whenever you looked at the screen, you could actually see a conical beam of light sort of wide where the screen was, and then going backwards, narrowing down. Because there was smoky, the light would be reflected, so you can actually see the beam. And if you sometimes stop looking at the screen and find out where all this was coming from, where the source was, you can actually follow that cone of light, the great diversity, going to one point of unity in this little room in the back of the cinema with a bloke and this machine and this little like plastic going through the machine. That's what it was. So if you actually follow the movie to its source, you see, it wasn't aliens on that screen. No one was dying. There was not a pretty girl on there falling in love with a good man. So why would you cry and get sort of emotionally excited? It was just a piece of celluloid going through a piece of light. That's all you could see it. When you actually saw where it was all coming from, you got detachment. No desire, no ill will. No crying, no laughing. It's just plastic, celluloid going through light, that's all. And that's a good simile of contemplation. You might contemplate the screen again and again and again. How about finding out where that screen is coming from? Where will comes from? Where knowing comes from? Instead of just looking at consciousness, see the source of consciousness. Like following it through to the one pointed, going in to the centre of things, where things are coming from. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi made a beautiful distinction between the meaning of the word Dhamma is like the origin of things, the source of things. It's the experience going to its origin. That's what Dhamma is. From the experience of now, where it comes from. You see where it comes from, the source, that's Dhamma. just like the screen is the experience in one cinema. The Dhamma is actually that little box in the back of the cinema with the bloke, with the machine, the light and the celluloid. You see where it's coming from, the origin. When you see that, the delusion is broken. This is not a self, this is not a me, this is not a doer. It's just a process, that's all. It's almost like a little machine, churning in, churning it out. Make sense? That's what contemplation is. Great question. Ajahn, could you please elaborate on how to raise the second indriya, energy? Okay. How to raise the second indriya, energy, is many ways of arousing that indriya. One is through fear. Imagine you're going to die tonight. Imagine if I turned out all the lights and then a snake, a venomous snake in this room. Would you be sleeping? Would sloth and torpor come into your mind? You know, it's very hot today. There are snakes in Perth. There's a big garden out there. Ooh. But that sort of fear is not really a good thing to play around with. But like the fear of the consequences of bad actions is sometimes good to raise energy. To realise that this is a precious human life. In this precious human life, we've actually met the Dhamma. And we've managed to come onto a retreat where we've managed to get the freedom, the precious opportunity to meditate all day with no business, with no distractions at all. This is an incredibly precious experience in samsara. You've been working eons for this retreat. Now it's here. Wow, that makes you energetic. But really, the best way to get energy is to be happy. Because that's the mental energy. To put forth fun into what you're doing. So meditate backwards. Still, I've mentioned to people, when you're meditating this hall, meditate the other way. Watch that one instead of this person. Do things differently. That will wake you up because you're radical, you're rebellion. Do things differently. This is like I like them saying, meditate the wrong way around, or meditate backwards, do the breath backwards. Or how about doing nimittas first and then finish off in present moment awareness? Whatever, just play around, listen around. You see, that makes you happy. When you're happy, you laugh. Is that energy? So this is actually, you develop energy in the mind. When you first get up in the morning, what do? Look in the mirror, smile. You make energy. So you can make energy, put happiness into your life, or you can get so negative and dull. And you actually use suck out energy. So it's up to you. They say that you can initiate energy. Once you initiate it, you start it, then it sort of runs all by itself. But sometimes it takes just, you know, to you to get it going. Once it gets going, then you're fine.
The Buddha actually
gives sit on this.
Amazing
energy. Well, he isn't. Yeah, it's only you is, no one else is. That was only in case you're very, very sleepy in class. And again, if it's because in this retreat you've got lots of time, and if it really is because of laziness, then fine, go pull your ears or wash your face or look at the stars or go walk backwards. Or do something which is different. Because a lot of times we get tired because of boredom and dullness. We always do things the same way. Get up in the morning, we have the same cup of tea out of the same cup. We brush our teeth from the same side of the mouth using the same toothpaste. And we just go through routines in life. That's what makes us dull. So don't be a person of routines. Do things differently. Even as you know, you've heard me say that tomorrow morning, when you brush your teeth, start at a different part of the mouth. Don't always brush your teeth from the same left-hand corner at the top. Do it at the bottom corner. Do it in the middle. Mess around. And then you'll find you have to be more awake when you're brushing your teeth. Simply because you're doing it differently. It makes you more alert, more awake. Turn your bed the other way around so you're not sleeping in the same position as you slept last night. then because you're doing things differently, you've got more energy. Actually, you might not even be able to go to sleep tonight if you do that. Different place, different position. Amazingly, if you do things differently, then you find you have more energy. So don't do the meditation always the same. Play around. Do things differently. Even sit differently. Okay, Ajahn, why don't we chant loving kindness in Pali too? Just a suggestion. Okay. We can chant loving kindness in Pali, but loving kindness chant has been translated into English, and it's such a lovely chant to actually to know the meaning of. It's great to do it in English. So actually we know exactly what it is and what it means, and we can reflect upon it. And those of you who don't know Pali, actually you know what you're chanting. And that really helps a lot, because otherwise you don't know what you're chanting, what you're saying. You could be saying, I give all my money to the Buddhist Society of WA, and I give all my money to the Buddhist Society of WA. And it's recorded, so we're going to... Dear Ajahn Brahmas, we have the good karma to attend your 9-day retreat. Can we also piggyback on you to go into the jhanas? Only the first one, please. You lazy... But actually, you do piggyback. Because, you know, whenever somebody gets into deep meditation, that affects everyone in the room. And that's what pulls people along. I don't know how it works, is that the energy. So that it's almost like a resonance. So once somebody gets blissful, you can actually feel the energy. You may not be able to feel it sort of consciously, but something knows it, and it pulls you in the same direction. So yeah, I mean, we do help each other that way. Thanks, emptiness, no question. That's very good. Next question. Where's the time going? As people become enlightened, there must come a time, perhaps after millions and millions of eons, when all beings become enlightened. What will happen then? Will a new class of beings come into existence and the whole process start over? Also, is there a constant number of beings in the universe, or are new ones created to replace the ones that become enlightened? My goodness, it's not like stocking our supermarket shelves. And actually, that question, Ananda asked that question to the Buddha, and he told him to, don't be stupid, you can't answer questions that such as that. So I better sort of not try it out to the Buddha. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a sutra which explains the difference between an Arya, extreme one to Phenomenon, who has attained mastery over the jhanas, and the uninstructed ordinary person, who has also mastery over the jhanas. The Buddha states that on the breakup of the body after death, both these people will be reborn in the jhana realms and stay there for the full lifespan. However, the Aryan attains parinibbana from that place, while the uninstructed ordinary person gets reborn into one of the woeful subhuman realms, that is, as a ghost, animal, or hell being. Can you please comment on this, especially in respect of the phrase samadhi pati yata buddhyana dasana, samadhi conditions, seeing things as they truly are? Thank you. Yeah, this is actually a very interesting sutra. I really sort of my eyes really was just focused on that when I first read it. What it means is, if you have the samadhi, the real samadhi, not just the map, but you've actually experienced, you're a stream winner, and you get into jhanas, you do a lot of jhanas, then when you die, the chances are that when you see that light at the end of the tunnel, you know, you'll actually know exactly what to do with that. You take it as a nimitta, you'll be able to hold it, because you practiced on jhanas before, and you get reborn in that jhana realm. If a stream winner gets reborn in that jhana realm, because they have seen non-self, and they know there's nothing there, and they've got into the state of completely abandoning temporarily the body, there is no way they'll ever come back anywhere. When that jhana realm dissipates, when the jhana ends, so do they. It's called in the commentaries the Jhan Anagami, a special type of Anagami. It's almost like a shortcut out of samsara, out of rebirth. If you actually know what the jhanas are, in those jhanas you actually no attachment to the body, no doing, no sensory desire at all. And because just after you come out of that, as it were, just on the edge of coming out of that, after that realm, if you're a stream winner, and in that type of mind-made body, then that's it, you've completely disappeared, you're gone. Your power in the nirvana there. However, if you're not a screen winner, and you have these jhanas, then, or if you die in a jhana, which is actually quite rare, it's very hard to jhana jhana, but if you do die in a jhana, then you go and get reborn immediately in the jhana realms. Which again is the same amount of bliss, just in the same way that people in jhanas, they can't come out for lunch or tea, they don't know what's going on, they're just blissed out of their little heads, having a great time. In the place after death where you get reborn, these last for eons. Way past the coming and going of universes, sometimes hundreds of eons in these jhana realms. You have a fine old time. The problem is that once that jhana dissipates, once you come out, then it's the next piece of karma which happens to come up. And that next piece of karma can be a karma which sends you to the lower realms, or to the human realms, or to the deva realms. It is actually possible to come straight out of a jhana realm and go straight to a hell realm. However, even though it's possible, it's very unlikely. Reason being is because to get those jhanas in the first place, you have to have such really strong purity of mind and purity of conduct. So the chances are that if you come out of a jhana realm, you'll either go to a human realm or a deva realm, simply because the amount of good conduct which you must have to get jhanas is huge. However, it is possible, this is what the Buddha was saying, it's possible you can go from the jhana realm straight to a lower realm. It won't be long, you may touch good karma, so you'll get back again. So that's actually what happens there. If you're a screen winner and get into jhanas, but you're not an anagami yet, you become tantamount to being an anagami, tantamount to being a non-returner. However, if you haven't got a screen winner and you get into a jhana realm, you can come down again afterwards. However, if you have got those jhanas, and you have got some good teachers around who tell you what they mean, then it's more than likely that you would actually, as it says here, from samadhi, from the jhanas, you see things as they truly are. And it's staring you in the face. So it's only if you know you've got some other views which you haven't heard about Buddhism before that you get a jhana or something, you can misinterpret it. But from the teachings of the Buddha or the teachings of the great masters, if you look at the jhana from that perspective, it's just so clear, so powerful, and your mind is just so strong that it's the chances are you won't miss it. You become at least a stream winner, which is why I really encourage jhanas, because you're giving yourself the maximum possible chance of entering the stream. And there's a good, more than probable chance that you will enter the stream after a good jhana, as long as you've got good instructions as well. That makes sense? Yes, Sanjay?
I have a follow-up question. For other religions, it's very common to have a jhana. If you follow the leader, then you are a member of that religion. But the Buddha Dharma has 8 steps, the 8 paths. And there isn't a 9th step which says it must be the Buddha Dharma. But it's implied. It's not explicit, it's implied. So what I'm wondering is, you said just now that people of other faiths may experience jhanas. And if they experience jhanas and they become a stream winner, then, and they go on to attaining nirvana, are they doing this without knowledge of the Buddha Dharma?
Yeah, indeed. Sometimes there are some beings called Pacheka Buddhas. People actually stumble upon that Dharma by themselves without even knowing it's called Buddhism. And they are beings who are just self-enlightened, as it were. They don't follow teachers. But I'll get to a jhana, say, for some degree of letting go. And as a result of that, manage actually to see for themselves, without even instructions. It's hard to do, it's very easy to miss. But if you've got the instructions and the map, it's almost impossible to miss. So those are very, very rare in the world, but it can happen, it does happen. So it is possible. But it's interesting, the Buddha gave this very good answer to the wanderer Subhadra, just in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the one who said, in other religions, are there stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and arahats? And the Buddha's answer was absolutely perfect. He said, don't call it another religion. So in any religion, in any practice, when people follow the Eightfold Path and they practice according to the Eightfold Path, then there will be stream winners, ones returners, non-returners, arahats in that religion. It doesn't matter what you call the religion or what you believe in, it's what you do. So, you know, if you have like teachings about karma and rebirth and non-self, you've got that as at least a suggestion, and then you practice the Eightfold Path and get jhanas, then you'll find eventually there will be stream winners there. Be once returners, non returners, arahats. If you don't, if there's one of those factors is missing, it's only a sevenfold path, if you don't practice mindfulness or sit, you don't practice meditation, then you won't have anything. It has to be an eightfold path, not a sevenfold or sixfold path. Okay, it's 9:10. Shall we continue on? We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more questions, or shall we leave until tomorrow? Can you put your hands up if you think we should continue on? Put your hands up if you, put your hands down. Put your hands up if you think we should stop. Okay, you've woken up both of you. Hopefully, sorry if you're a bit tired, but I'll try and go through them as quickly as possible. Before enlightenment, the Bodhisattva learns to master jhanas from the two teachers. Why these jhanas levels did not lead them to enlightenment? That's a moot point, a debatable point, whether the Buddha actually attained jhanas under those two masters. The reason why it's debatable is because after he left those two masters, Alaraka Lama, Udaka Ramaputta, that he looked back after all these ascetic practices, the only other time he'd experienced jhana was as a young boy under the rose apple tree. And you ask yourself, hang on, didn't he, if that was the only other time he attained jhanas, then what was he doing under the two teachers, Buddhaka Ramaputta and Alaraka Lama? And the answer is they could not have been actually real jhanas. Under those two teachers he was doing what's called the arupa attainment. But those arupa attainments, in my understanding and experience, have to be based on the jhanas. So they couldn't have been the real thing under that those two teachers. And it is a very, what we argue about, discuss with monks, it's still an open question. But my answer to it is that just in these days, that people can actually practice what they think are jhanas, but they're not the real thing. And you know, sometimes some teachers actually teach like ordinary states of jhanas. Now, as Ajahn Brahmagya teaches, actually, you know, a really very tough level to actually to get a jhana. You know, no thought, you know, complete absence of body, you can't hear anything, absolute stillness. So some people say it's too hard under Ajahn Brahm. Get to this other monk next door somewhere, and he teaches, you know, jhanas, you don't have to do that much to get a jhana. So yeah, we'll go to him, it's much easier. It's like sometimes some of the degrees, you can actually write to universities in the United States and get a degree through the post. But it's not a real degree in that sense. So I think even in those days there was probably sort of things which were called the arupa attainments but weren't the real things. Because if they were the real things, that would be such a strong attainment, the Buddha could have used those to become enlightened. It would not needed to have gone back to the experience as a child under the rose apple tree when he first got jhana. That's my understanding of it. We still argue about this, discuss this in the monastery at a certain time. But that's the only thing which makes sense to me. They were teaching the Buddha the attainment of nothingness and the attainment of neither perception nor non-perception, which are two arupa attainments, usually based on fourth jhana.
So this thinking about what jhana and the other jhana was around before the Buddha's enlightenment. Is it a on or a spin-off or something like that?
This we don't know. There's many other places where they said there was like almost like echoes of old teachings, even like verses which weren't really complete. Now there were sort of teachings from the past which were still extant there, but they weren't really fully known, fully understood. And it's my understanding is that what Alaraka Lama Udaka Ramaputta did was just that of teachers, teachings and teachers of old, which weren't fully understood. as if like, you know, the word jhana remained, but the experience had long since gone. And so they took some experiences to be those things, but they weren't the real thing. But the real jhanas, you know, there was the first jhana experienced by the Buddha wasn't known. It was forgotten a long time ago, which is why the Buddha mentioned that he discovered an ancient path which was overgrown, hadn't been actually used, which was the Eightfold Path. And it's fair to say that the jhana is the culmination of that Eightfold Path.
So it's not really correct to think that the teachings that he was being taught here and then the following teachings of Buddha are offsprings from, like for example, the Upanishads, which were written about 150, 200 years earlier than that.
Well, actually, that's another question which is debatable, whether the Upanishads came earlier or later than Buddhism. And certainly there's some Upanishads almost certainly later than Buddhism, however that the Hindus would really argue against that because there's an idea that the more old they are, the more legitimate they are, but the evidence behind that is very, very shaky. For example, one of the Upanishads was written by Ajatasattu, King Ajatasattu, which is in the Buddhist canon, just took the kingship of the last year of the Buddha's death. When they say written by these people, what they would do, they'd be written by some sage, and they would actually be given to the king, as if, you know, the king wrote it, as a means of patronage. So that everyone knew the king would not write that, but he was a patron, the sponsor of that work. And that actually dates that pretty accurately, you know, to the end of the Buddha's life. And it's fascinating that even though the Buddha sort of discusses theories of other teachers, there's no discussion of the Upanishads anywhere in the suttas, which is actually a good suggestion that they weren't around.
Would it have much to say about Jainism at all?
Absolutely, yes. Heaps about it. He discussed all the main teachers at the time and travelled extensively throughout India. And so it's a big, you know, it's a gaping hole there. Where are the Upanishads in the Buddha's teaching? And the only logical inference is they weren't around at that time, but they came afterwards as a reaction to the Buddha's teachings. And that's actually much more likely. And as actually Rice David said, that there's no mention of jhanas in any text prior to the Buddha's text. That's the first time the word was mentioned. Dear Ajahn, can you please explain how the stream winner sees the other shore? How does he perceive it in his mind? Okay, the place of safety, the end of suffering. So one sees that what suffering is caused by desire, caused by the sense of self. As long as there's a self, there's a me, then there will be a mine. And when there's a mine, there's attachment, there's clinging, there's picking up, grasping, and then there has to be suffering as a result. We also see that when there's birth, there has to be suffering. And the whole purpose of this is to stop being born. We see that all existence, all consciousness, all perceptions, all feeling, wherever, is subject to suffering. That happiness is just the gap between 2 moments of suffering. And suffering is just the gap between 2 moments of happiness. So how can one get perfect happiness? Except when everything stops. One sees that that's the only place of safety and peace. When everything ceases and stops. But one doesn't, stream winner doesn't always perceive it like that. Sometimes they forget. Because their mindfulness is not perfected. They don't always remember. It hasn't really fully sunk in to every moment of their experience. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your inspiring retreats over the years. The process is coming on slowly but surely. I would like to suggest a special meta session for Ron and Bianca, as they have been the backbone for organising the retreats. Thanks again. Yeah, we'll certainly do that at the very last day. A friend recently asked me what was the Buddhist stance on suicide, as a relation of that friend who recently had an assisted suicide. Can you tell me, please? If it's an assisted suicide, assisted euthanasia, it really depends on one's intention, why one is doing it. So often when we talk about karma, people try and make it black karma or white karma. It's much better, much closer to the truth, to call it like shades of grey. This big bad karma and this huge bad karma, and this medium bad karma, and this small bad karma, this tiny bad karma, this tiny good karma, this medium good karma, this big good karma, and this mega good karma. You know what mega good karma is? Karma in a meditation retreat. Yeah. This is mega good karma. It is, because it gets close to enlightenment. So that sometimes, like this, like karma which is on the edge, and usually assisted suicide is on the grey edge, on the back side of things. It's bad karma, but sometimes it can be so close to that midpoint. Sometimes you think, is it good karma, is it bad karma? What's really going on? And so in those cases you have to really, you can't give a black and white answer, that's good, that's bad. You have to actually test out, is it done through delusion, or is it done through wisdom, through actually thinking things through, getting all the evidence, seeing what's going on? Is it done through ill will, depression, or is it done through loving kindness? Why is it done? What's the intention? What's the purity of the intention? Because there are times, or sometimes, especially arahats in the time of the Buddha, could actually kill themselves, and the Buddha said there's no fault there at all. That's an extreme case. But when there's an extreme case, it shows it is possible to actually to have suicide without any bad karma whatsoever. But that's rare, that's usually only arahats. Usually the suicide is, say, is an unskillful action. Usually it is done out of depression, ill will, and not being in a peaceful, clear state of mind. However, there's sometimes assisted suicide when people, because their life is coming to an end, and they're in great pain, or that fellow Mr. Dead, the first person with assisted suicide, who was a Buddhist, the reason why he had assisted suicide, assisted euthanasia, was not out of ill will towards his condition, not out of pain or desire. The whole reason why he decided to be the first person who had legally assisted euthanasia in Darwin was because of his compassion towards his wife, who had to be looking after him 24 hours a day, who had no life of her own, was doing this for such a long time, and without him sort of assisted suicide, she'd probably still be doing this. And so he did this thinking that it was the best thing he could do for his wife. And for that I can't judge him. If it was bad karma, it's just tiny bad karma, it might even be good karma. So in extreme situations like that, you can actually see that there's no black and white answer. And anyone who tries to do a black and white answer is not seeing the full picture. And you know from your experience, from your own feelings, what's good and what's bad. And sometimes you can't say that's bad karma. You feel it's not bad karma, you know it's not bad karma. And therefore, if it's feeling like that, it usually is not bad karma. Oh, long question here. I remember reading in the introduction to Majjhima Nikaya, Bhikkhu Bodhi writing the definition of Nirvana as just the ending of the five khandhas. It's not quite precise. It refers to some famous passages in the suttas where the Buddha is rousing his five khandhas because with a Dharma talk on Nirvana, when the Buddha says, there is bhikkhus, the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unconditioned. If bhikkhus there was not this unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, originated, created and conditioned. But since there is an unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unconditioned, therefore an escape is discerned. Another passage of Buddha refers to Nibbana as a sphere or base, where there is neither this world nor another nor both. Here bhikkhus, it says there is no coming and going, no staying, no deceasing, no uprising, not fixed, not movable, it is no support, is unconditioned, justice is the end of suffering. Can you please comment on these passages for us? Okay, there was a lovely story of Anuruddha, who was one of the chief disciples of the Buddha. And in this life, he had such good karma from the past that he would never hear the word, there isn't. That was because of some good karma he did. So whatever he wanted, you would never hear the word, there isn't any. So if you wanted some food, you could never hear the word, there isn't any. He'd always get whatever he needed. And so as a young boy, he was playing marbles with some friends. And it was like gambling. And his mother made him all these cakes for his lunch, and he was gambling his cakes away, his lunch, with his mates, you know, like kids playing, being kids. and he kept on losing all his cakes. So he sent his servant, because he was a very rich young man, sent his parents back home to get some more cakes to gamble. So the servant came with some more cakes, and then he lost those again. He sent his servant back again, he got some more cakes, and then eventually there was no more cakes left in the house. So his mother said, and I told the servant to take the bowl back and say there isn't any cakes. And so the servant went with the bowl covered with the message, there isn't any cakes. Now the devas, who have to, their job is actually to make sure that these determinations, you know, the karma actually works, they got concerned and said, this guy can't hear this word, so we've got to do something. So they put in these deva cakes into the bowl, these really heavenly cakes. And so when the servant came, he opened up the bowl, there isn't any cakes. And so Aniruddha thought these cakes were called, there isn't any. You know, just like you get chocolate cake, you get rice cake, this was there isn't any cake. And when he tasted these there isn't any cakes, they were just so delicious. He never tasted any cakes like these. And so he sent the servant back and said, tell off my mother, why haven't you ever cooked me any there isn't any cake before? Now I demand in the future always to get there isn't any cake. He thought it was the name of the cake. And that's actually in the story. And sometimes people think uncreated is the name of a state. They think that unborn is the name of a state. That unconditioned is the name of a state. Just like there isn't any is the name of a cake. This is like the way of negative things. And they say, it's nothing. Isn't anything. And I think that nothing is this amazing state where you get reborn into. Now you see the problem here with trying to describe things. No matter what words you use, if you want to have some place where you can exist forever after, then whatever you call it, it's nothing. You say, oh, nothing is where you go to, where you die. Like Nibbana literally means like going out, ceasing. So people think that's the name of the heaven, the going out, the ceasing heaven, where you get reborn into. And you've got to be very, very careful there. So it's true that those suttas actually exist. First of all, you have to really check the translations, and they can be very easily translated in a way which actually suggests there is something there. There is the unborn. You might as well translate that there is no born. There is no originated. There is no created. There is no conditioned. You can translate it that way if you wish. But the point is here that there's like an ending of being. There's an ending of conditioning. And this is actually where you actually understand what Nibbana is all about. So the words which you read in the suttas, if you haven't got experience, because sometimes can, just like natty cakes, there isn't any cakes, be misinterpreted to think that natty cakes, that natty was actually the Pali word, there isn't any. You think that there isn't any is the name of a cake. Where really it means it's nothing, it's gone, empty.
Is that what happens in the Theravada, where you talk about Buddha nature and that sort of stuff, and it's almost as construed as a state where you think about the realizations of the Buddha?
Yeah.
It's just what you mean, something.
Correct, yes. So you might call it Buddha nature, you might call it emptiness, and you may call it all sorts of things. People can make like an altar out of that. And you say, Mahayana, it just is nothing there. It's emptiness, gone, finished. You can call it whatever you like, but there's nothing there. Don't say, nothing. This is actually some real thing. You know, which is you make into sort of the universe. This is actually the problem. But the way you find out there is from experience, and when you experience these things, everything going, you realise there's nothing there. The great question is, why do you want to keep something? Why do you want to keep anything? It's a nice question. Why do you want to be? Dear Ajahn, while meditating I saw a light coming in from both sides. I thought someone had turned on the lights as I opened my eyes to check. Then I lost it. What was it? Could we have been satipanas in our previous lives? Okay. Yeah, sometimes it really depends what this person was doing. So like sometimes people take photographs with their flash cameras, and that might be what's happening. Oh, I thought that was a libertine. It's only someone taking them. No, it's sometimes that it could be a nimitta coming up, but it really depends on whether your meditation is very deep or not. So whoever asked that question, next time in the interview, you can actually ask me, and I can ask you what you were doing at the time to find out whether it was a nimitta or not. But sometimes that happens, the mind gets very, very bright. It looks like the light is on, but it's not on at all. That light is coming from your mind. Energies are coming up. Things are happening. Whoopee! And could we have been sotapannas in our previous lives? Yeah, this is an interesting thing. If you were sotapanna in your last life, and you get reborn in the human realm, does that mean you have to be a Buddhist in this life? Does that mean you're born with a bald head and have to be a monk? Does that mean you have to keep the precepts from the time you were a baby? Does that mean as soon as you're born that you have faith in the Buddha and the Dhamma and you understand non-self? Fascinating question. My answer is, and apparently some of the other Kuba Ajahns agree with this, is if you were streamlined in your past life, as a baby, as a young child, you'd be obviously a very, very good child. But not sort of a perfect child. But there will come a time in your life where you have to re-experience what you experienced in the previous life. You have to go through the same process of seeing the Dhamma, seeing the far shore, to be a stream winner again. Usually very early on in your life. Only if you have to develop memories of past lives. So not necessarily so. Does that make sense? It's just if you were a stream winner before, you have to have that same experience again of seeing the Dhamma in this life. So you're not born a stream winner again. Well, you are born a stream winner in a sense, but you don't know the Dhamma when you're young, when you're a baby. You haven't got the facilities, the faculties to know that. But there has to come a time when you actually get into some deep meditation or some deep state and you see, oh, there's no self. Understand Buddhism, understand Dhamma. Okay. No, too late. Because it's 9:30 now and some people are very, very tired. So thank you for those really deep questions. And great having deep questions because they make the question time very interesting. So thanks again for that. If there's some questions I didn't answer correctly, please write them down again for tomorrow night. And those ones who use the toilet paper, whatever, we have got proper paper around. So have a nice evening. Oh, by the way, there's no bell anymore. I've cancelled all the bells. So you can sleep whenever you want, wake up whenever you want. So this is like free, unconditioned meditation retreat. No bell is ringing in the morning. So when you hear it, it's no bell. Ding, ding, ding. That's what no bell sounds like.